We're now in 1470, 15 years away from the Battle of Bosworth, the slaying of Richard III, the end of the Wars of the Roses, and the coming of a new age of English history. For the moment, England has two kings, one locked in the Tower, Henry VI, and one keeping him there, Edward IV. But Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, and the Duke of Clarence, the king's brother, have landed at Dartmouth from France. Much of southern England welcomes Warwick, who marches on London and frees Henry VI from the Tower. He's been there for 5 years, so he's now back on the throne, and Edward IV flees the country. But Warwick has made a serious mistake. Clarence had deserted his brother, Edward IV, for Warwick's side, because Warwick had promised him that he, Clarence, would be the next king. But when Edward IV returned to fight Warwick, Clarence joined with his brother, fought Warwick's army, defeated it, and that was the end of Warwick, the kingmaker. As Warwick was dying, Queen Margaret was landing with her army and the young Prince of Wales at Weymouth. The two sides met at Tewkesbury. Margaret's army was defeated. Edward IV then returned to London, dragged out the hapless King Henry, and beheaded him. Once again, that should have been that. But the king, his wife, Queen Elizabeth, and the king's loyal brother, Richard of Gloucester, were waiting for the curtain to rise on the next act. It did, in 1483.
Queen Elizabeth had produced two fine boys. One was 12 and the other 9. The succession to the crown seemed secure. The king himself was only 40. His main thought was set on securing the crown to his son, the unfledged Edward V. But in 1483, death came so suddenly upon him that he had no time to take the necessary precautions. After only 10 days' illness, this strong king was cut down in his prime. It may well have been appendicitis, an explanation as yet unknown. He died unprepared, except by the church, and his faithful brother Richard of Gloucester saw himself confronted with an entirely new view of his future. A protectorate was inevitable. Richard stood forth without compare, and had been nominated by the late king himself.
At what point Richard planned to be king is uncertain, but within a few weeks he was. He first arrested Earl Rivers and Sir Richard Grey, accusing them of plotting. They were the young prince's minders. 2 weeks later, he'd lodged the 12-year-old Edward V in the Tower. Shortly afterwards, Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, was persuaded to part with her other son, the 9-year-old Duke of York. Now, both princes were in the Tower. All Richard had to do now was to convince Parliament and the people that the late king's marriage to Elizabeth Woodville was invalid, and therefore that their heirs had no right to the throne. To make the point, Richard's chaplain was sent to St. Paul's Cross in London to preach the sermon that would explain the church's view. It didn't quite work as Richard had intended.
On the second Sunday after Lord Hastings' execution, there being present the Lord Protector, the Duke of Buckingham, and a large audience of laity and clergy, Dr. Ralph Shah declared, and proved by reasons as he devised there and then, that the children of King Edward were not the rightful heirs of the crown, and that King Edward was not the legitimate son of the Duke of York as the Lord Protector was. He then alleged that the Lord Protector was most worthy to be king and none other, which sermon offended so greatly the greater part of that audience, that whereas before that time the said doctor was held to be most famous and holy in the minds of the common people, after this day he was held in little repute or regard. Then on the Tuesday after this Sunday, the Duke of Buckingham came to the Guildhall. The Duke made an oration which lasted a good half hour, recounting the excellence of the Lord Protector, the many virtues with which God had endowed him, and the rightful title he had to the throne. When he had finished, and well exhorted the assembly to accept the Lord Protector to be their liege lord and king, a small number of his listeners cried, "Yea," to satisfy his mind, and more for fear than for love.
But Richard was not unduly put out by this lack of spontaneous approval. Parliament was the important body, not the people. 2 days later, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, was proclaimed King Richard III. However, from the day of his coronation, there's a sense that the new king was not trusted by his people, nor by many of his magnates.
No man had done more to place Richard upon the throne than the Duke of Buckingham, and upon no one had the king bestowed greater gifts and favours. Yet, during these first 3 months of Richard's reign, Buckingham, from being his chief supporter, became his mortal foe. His motives are not clear. Perhaps he shrank from becoming the accomplice in what he foresaw would be the closing act of usurpation. So we come to the principal crime ever afterwards associated with Richard's name. According to Thomas More's story, Richard resolved in July to extirpate the menace to his peace and sovereignty presented by the princes. He sent a special messenger by name John Green to Brackenbury, the constable of the Tower, with orders to make an end of them. Brackenbury refused to obey. "Whom should a man trust," exclaimed the king, "when those who I thought would most surely serve at my command will do nothing for me?" A page who heard this outburst reminded his master that Sir James Tyrrell, one of Richard's former companions in arms, was capable of anything. Tyrrell was sent to London with a warrant authorizing Brackenbury to deliver to him for one night all the keys of the Tower. Tyrrell discharged his fell commission with dispatch. One of the four jailers in charge of the princes, Forrest by name, was found willing, and with Dighton, Tyrrell's own groom, did the deed. When the princes were asleep, the two assassins pressed pillows hard down upon their faces till they were suffocated. It was not until Henry VII's reign, when Tyrrell was lying in the Tower under sentence of death for quite a separate crime, that he is alleged to have made confession, upon which, with much other circumstantial evidence, the story as we know it rests.
And now, back to the Duke of Buckingham. He was conspiring with the Countess of Richmond, who, as a Beaufort, was a descendant of John of Gaunt, and therefore in the Lancastrian line of Edward III. She'd married the Earl of Richmond, who was now dead. Their son, Henry Tudor, was now Earl of Richmond. As the plot was drawn, Henry Tudor was in Brittany, in exile after a previous Lancastrian loss.
Buckingham's preparations were for a general rising on October the 18th. But the anger of the people at the rumoured murder deranged the plan. In Kent, Wiltshire, Sussex and Devonshire, there were risings 10 days before the appointed date. King Richard marched against the rebellion. Buckingham losses Melway. Buckingham's, with a price on head, was but to Richard, who lost not an hour in having him slaughtered. The usual crop of executions followed. Order was restored throughout the land, and the king seemed to have established himself securely upon his throne. A terrible blow now fell upon him. In April 1484, his only son, Prince of Wales, died, whose wife, whose health was broken, could bear no more children. Henry Tudor, Earl of Richmond, now became obviously the rival claimant and successor to the throne. As the months passed, many prominent Englishmen, both Yorkist and Lancastrian, withdrew themselves from Richard's baleful presence and made their way to Richmond, who stood at the head of a combination which might well unite all England. The suspense was wearing to Richard. He felt he was surrounded by hatred and distrust. He fixed his headquarters in a good central position at Nottingham. On August the 1st, Richmond embarked at Harfleur with his Englishmen, Yorkist as well as Lancastrian, and a body of French troops, and landed at Milford Haven on the 7th. He had only 2,000 men, but such were his assurances of support that he proclaimed Richard forthwith usurper and rebel against himself. The Duke of Norfolk and Percy, Earl of Northumberland, were Richard's principal adherents. They had no hope of life but in their master's victory. On August the 17th, thus attended, the king set forth towards Leicester at the head of his army.
The king had 10,000 men, well-disciplined troops. Richmond's forces were rebels. The wild card, or unknown factor, was Lord Stanley's forces. The king, doubtful of him, had held his son and threatened to behead him if his father failed to support the royal standard. Stanley, at the last moment, when the battle appeared to be going for Richard, joined Richmond. We have an account of what happened next, and the fate of Richard, in Polydore Virgil's Anglica Historia. The battle is now bloody and hot, and Richard, the king, has seen his enemy, Henry Tudor.
When Earl Henry was drawing nearer, King Richard knew it perfectly by evident signs and tokens that it was Henry. Wherefore, all flamed with fire, he struck his horse with spurs, ran against out of his own army ahead of vanguard. King Richard, at the first brunt, killed some men and overthrew Henry's standard, together with William Brandon, the standard-bearer. Then he matched himself against John Chaney, a man of such strength, far exceeding the common sort, who strove with him as he came. But the king, with great force, drove him to the ground, making way with his weapon on every side. But yet Henry abode the brunt longer than even his own soldiers would have thought, who were almost out of hope of victory, when suddenly William Stanley with 3,000 men came to the rescue. Then truly in a moment the remainder fled, and King Richard was killed in the thickest press of his enemies. Many forbore to fight who came to the field with King Richard, for awe and for no good will, and departed without any danger, as men who desired not the safety but destruction of that prince whom they hated. The body of King Richard, naked of all clothing and laid upon a horse's back, with arms and legs hanging down both sides, was brought to the abbey at Leicester, a miserable spectacle in good truth, but not unworthy for the man's life, and was buried there 2 days afterwards, without any pomp or solemn funeral. He was little of stature, deformed of body, the one shoulder being higher than the other, with a curt and sour countenance which seemed to savour of mischief, and manifested clearly craft and deceit. While he was thinking of any matter, he did continually bite his nether lip, as though that cruel nature of his did so rage against itself in that little carcass.
And that was the Battle of Bosworth, the end of the Wars of the Roses. Wars that had made little difference to the daily lives of the peoples of England. Kings, princes, dukes, earls, and knights had been beheaded at the block, slaughtered on the field. But for most people in 15th-century England, life had continued at the same pace, among the same families, with the same ambitions. Yet it was a point from which historians would look back some 600 years and talk about the Middle Ages. But ages, eras, do not actually end with dates. There are no full stops in history, and so we can't seriously join the hunt for the day the Middle Ages finished. What we can say is that Bosworth Field in the month of August 1485 was the start of the Tudors. Oh, and just a footnote to the Wars of the Roses. No one at the time called them that. It looks very much as if the first person to refer to them in that way was Sir Walter Scott in his novel Anne of Gerstein. And that wasn't until 1829.
Tomorrow we'll hear more about the Tudors, Henry VII. Anna Massey was reading this Sceptre Dial by Christopher Lee. You also heard Paul Eddington and